On the program today, kind of an economic whodunit. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday, today the 20th of December. Good as always to have you along, everybody. So, here we are at the end of a year during which there was almost literally a 100% expectation that we were going to have a recession. Somebody, though, forgot to tell the economy, and the question is, what happened and who gets the credit? Rachel Siegel and her colleague Jeff Stein went through a list of particulars in the Washington Post. Rachel's here to talk about it. Rachel, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kai. Thanks so much for having me.
So let us go through that list of usual suspects. I want to talk about the Fed, and I want to talk about this thing that you quote Jay Powell as having said last week in a forum. He said, and I'm paraphrasing here, I always felt that because the circumstances are so unusual, we had a chance to get there without too much pain. And I guess my question is, did the Fed kind of get lucky that the economy is so weird after the pandemic, if you know what I mean?
I know what you mean, and it's a question that I put to people in working on this story. Was there a dose of luck here that obviously came off of years of a lot of bad luck, but how do we sort of break down how the economy got here? And I think there's probably a little splash of that, but it's also impossible to look at the economy now and the way it's performing and not draw a pretty straight line to what the Fed did. They managed to raise interest rates by moving at a breakneck pace. Yep. They got inflation under control, and normally those two things would spell a recession, and that's not what ended up happening.
But as you point out, it was not just interest rates that did it, right? The Fed had some you know, augmenting factors here.
Well, the Fed had parts of the economy that it didn't even expect to perform the way that it did, right? They were able to keep interest rates high in a way that cooled some parts of the economy, but allowed others to keep moving. People kept on spending. Employers kept on hiring. Conventional economic models would tell you that those are two things that would really go by the wayside with high rates. But I think the Fed managed to keep that momentum going and ride that momentum and also know that it was going to have to stick to message anyway, that it couldn't see signs as premature victories. It couldn't decide, oh, you know what? Actually, this is a little bit easier than we thought. They stuck to message all the way through. They said that they would not flinch until inflation came under control. Even now, they're not saying that the job is done, but they managed to stick through it. And now things are looking better than anyone could have expected.
Right. Let's get to usual suspect number two, the White House. The headline on this piece, and yes, reporters don't write their own headlines. It's everybody expected a recession. The Fed and the White House found a way out. What credit, with the acknowledgement that the White House often gets more credit and more blame than it deserves for economic circumstance, what does the White House get credit for here?
Well, the White House has many more tools at its disposal to target specific parts of the economy. And I should note here that hopefully our story didn't suggest at all that the White House and Fed were, you know, in coordination with any of this. Right. But what the White House was able to do was target specific points of pain. They were able to look at supply chains and try to ease the pressure there by getting ports to open 24/7. They were able to release strategic fuel reserves to try and get gas prices under control when they shot up in 2022. And they were also able to move through with specific platforms and agendas around infrastructure, around getting those supply chains stronger for the next time, around a huge stimulus push that allowed people to keep on spending that money and for businesses to keep on growing. So I think in a lot of ways, they're trying now to celebrate this really strong economy that also has links to what they did over the past few years. But their tools are really just much more specific here.
Right, right. Important to note here that President Biden, like most other presidents, not all, has been careful not to try to influence the Federal Reserve. Let me ask you a question, though, that sort of involves a little, you know, looking backwards and forwards at the same time. Had Rafael Bostic on the program the other day, the president of the Atlanta Fed, and I asked him, you know, if we had come to you in January and said, what's the economy going to look like in December, would this have been what you said? And he was like, yeah, you know, this worked out pretty well. I wonder how common that belief really is, though.
I mean, I think that there is certainly a sense of relief and a real sense of, you know, the Fed stuck to a plan, it stuck to it all the way through, and the plan proved right. I certainly wouldn't have been one of those people who you know, would have thought that things would have turned out this way. And I think that even Fed officials would admit that they couldn't have explained this perfectly. They couldn't have said, you know what, consumer spending is just going to continue to stun us. GDP is going to grow like gangbusters in the third quarter. The job market is going to slow, but really not by much. Maybe they would have hoped for, you know, unemployment to stay in check, inflation to ease. But I think that it's just remarkable that even by some of the most optimistic estimates, maybe including President Bostic's, that this is the economy that we got.
Super, super quick. I'm talking like 15 seconds. Downside risks here?
Well, I mean, we're not done all the way yet. And there are plenty of risks. There are two wars going on. There are any number of unforeseen shocks that could pop up next year. And that's why you won't hear anyone declaring victory yet.
Rachel Siegel at the Washington Post. Rachel, thanks so much. I really appreciate it. Great piece.
Thanks, Guy.
On Wall Street today, so look, Virginia, maybe there's not going to be a Christmas rally this year, huh? Details, numbers, y'all know the drill. As I was just talking about with Rachel, if you'd asked most economists, maybe not Raphael Bostic, but most economists back in January, where they thought this year would end up in this economy, not too many of them would have said, 5% growth, unemployment at 3.7, inflation at 3.1. We're going to look at housing now with that same kind of question. We've learned this week that housing starts are up, existing home sales are up, but is that going to hold up? We asked Marketplace's Justin Ho to step into a time machine and report back from the housing market this time next year.
All right, so it's December 2024. Taylor Swift is still the most popular musical artist in the country. People are still hyperventilating about AI. And the housing construction pipeline is doing okay. Charlie Docherty is an economist at Wells Fargo.
Single-family construction is certainly improving.
Now, that probably sounds a little underwhelming. That's because homebuilders are still dealing with many of the same issues they were facing in 2023.
You know, the supply side for homebuilders is still constrained, right? Lots are still challenging to find. Labor, still expensive. Building materials, still hard to come by.
As a result, home prices in 2024 have been growing at a modest pace, says Odetta Kushi, deputy chief economist at First American.
So not too hot like they were over the pandemic with double-digit house price growth, but still positive due to the ongoing supply and demand imbalance in the housing market.
One reason supply and demand are still out of whack is because demand has increased. That's because in 2024, mortgages have gotten less expensive.
They started the year much closer to 7%. Now we're close to 6%.
Mike Frattantoni is chief economist at the Mortgage Bankers Association. He says the Federal Reserve has indeed cut rates a few times. That's after the economy went through a short recession, he says, and inflation kept coming down. But from the perspective of 2023, Frattantoni says that economic outlook isn't all that scary.
We expect consumer spending gaining strength over the course of 2024, and certainly expect the pace of home sales to be picking up as we get through the year.
Frattantoni says housing was the first sector to suffer a downturn when the Fed started raising rates. That means it'll be the first to recover when the Fed starts cutting them. Reporting from 2024, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Might have seen the other day that McDonald's is opening up a new beverage-focused brand, Cosmix, it'll be called. First location just outside Chicago, hoping to take market share from beverage competitors like Starbucks and Dunkin' Donuts. Why, though, is a venerable fast food name, emphasis there on food, switching sides? Marketplace's Kristen Schwab is on the food and beverage desk today, emphasis on beverage.
There are some small luxuries consumers are willing to spend money on, even when they're watching their wallets. Lipstick is a classic example. And a rising category is drinks. Jen Wu is a partner at LEK Consulting.
They'll trade down on the big ticket items. So eating out is one. But they'll still want to indulge in those everyday moments.
Wu says spending on beverages is growing faster than on food.
Consumers are looking more and more for, you know, how is this different for me? How does this suit my needs? You're much easily able to customize beverage versus food.
Oat milk, cold foam, a pump of pomegranate syrup, the combinations are endless, and they're lucrative. In the last year, Starbucks has done $1 billion in sales from drink modifications alone. Max Johnson is a sales manager at BevSource.
Everybody knows that people mark up alcohol to an insane degree. The same concept does apply with beverages in fast food chains.
The classic case of this is soda, which costs businesses pennies. Problem is, soda is not as popular these days. People are looking for function and fun. Cosmix offers vitamin C boosters, pre-workout shots, and tapioca pearls.
Many of these better-for-you beverages don't come in a concentrated syrup form.
Putting them on the menu at existing McDonald's would take up too much real estate. Sean Dunlop, an analyst at Morningstar, thinks of these specialty Cosmix locations as an experiment for the company.
And if they completely bomb, it doesn't tarnish the McDonald's brand at all.
And if they take off, the burger chain can start selling the top-performing drinks at its regular locations. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
This time of year is, for many, a time of traditions. Personal, family, and business traditions, too. And sometimes all three rolled in together. In Albuquerque, New Mexico, tamales are a traditional centerpiece of many a family's holiday meal, and supplying them is a big business. As it happens, we here at Marketplace have a budding holiday tradition of checking in with a couple of local tamale makers in Albuquerque. Marketplace's Savannah Marr brings us an update.
2 weeks before Christmas, Cheryl Ramirez has crossed a few items off her holiday list. New Mexico red and green chilies, lots of corn flour. But she still has some shopping to do, starting at Albertsons, where she's ringing up 10 pork butts.
One guess what I'm making.
Tamales?
Yes.
25 years ago, Cheryl started taking holiday orders from her friends and family, who recommended her to their friends and family and neighbors and coworkers until she was basically running a seasonal small business. This year, she's on track to fill at least 250 orders. That's about 3,000 tamales out of her home kitchen. And she's been keeping an eye out for deals on ingredients, like 99 cents a pound for pork.
For the close to 100 pounds of meat, some salt and garlic, yeah, it was $97. Which is a really great deal.
For the second year in a row, Cheryl is keeping her tamale prices steady at just $20 a dozen. At her next stop, a restaurant supply warehouse, she explains that's despite some major cost increases for her. Take the 25-pound buckets of lard she needs to make masa.
So these used to be about $25, and now they're $60.
Cheryl says she can offset that by shopping for deals on other ingredients, and keeping her prices low gives her an edge with customers over larger operations that aren't as nimble. Like La Mexicana Restaurant and Tortilla Company, where owner Marco Nunez says holiday orders account for nearly 40% of yearly business.
Hey Marco, how are you?
The restaurant is so packed at lunchtime that we have to step outside to chat. A huge improvement over last year, when Marco was having such a hard time staffing up that he had to close the dining room in December to focus on filling tamale orders.
That was a huge issue. This year, it seems like people are more wanting to work.
Marco raised prices on sit-down meals to avoid another price increase for tamales, now $25 a dozen. And he says order volumes are trending back up.
I think it's more people are getting together. You know, they're more comfortable having the whole family over. We've had like a few office parties and stuff, which were nothing last year.
Marco brings me to the back of the house, where workers are mixing masa for tamales and tortillas.
Starts off as just corn.
Just one ingredient that's gotten more expensive, even in the last few weeks.
It went up 20%, and then all of a sudden, they called my mom and said, your next order is going to be up 35%. So we're at 55% literally in a matter of like 2 months.
Plus, he's paying some of his new hires as much as $15 an hour, more than twice what he did before the pandemic.
Usually Christmas is where we kind of get extra for the year. We're just going to be even, you know what I mean? Which we're thankful for, but the dynamic has definitely changed.
Just down the road from La Mexicana at a Mexican market, Cheryl is picking up her last ingredient, corn husks, for wrapping the tamales.
Gracias.
Cheryl is expecting a pretty healthy profit this year.
Probably close to about 4,000.
And last year you spent your tamale money on a Steelers game, right?
Yes, I did. And then I got stuck in Pittsburgh for a week almost because of the weather, but it was worth it.
This year she's investing back into the business.
Because I love cooking. I love it. So I'm gearing towards either a food truck or just an actual location.
Tamales are Cheryl's longtime holiday side hustle. But this time next year, maybe I'll be visiting her at her restaurant. In Albuquerque, I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
Coming up.
These dossiers can include hundreds or even thousands of data points about us.
Politics in the information economy. First, though, let's do the numbers. I was totally expecting the Wawas. How about that? Dow Industrial's off 475 points today, about 1.25%, 37,082. The NASDAQ lost 225 points, 1.5%, 14,777. S&P 500 down 70 points, almost 1.5% there, 46.98. We heard from Kristen Schwab about restaurant chains going big on customizable beverages, like that new spinoff of McDonald's. Well, parent company McDonald's down 0.6%. Starbucks down 3.1%. FedEx reported weaker than expected earnings. FedEx down 12%. Competitor UPS fell 2.9%. That FedEx report yesterday, by the way. Bond prices were up. The yield on the 10-year T-note down to 3.85%. In the continuing belief of this program, the context is everything. 2 months ago, it was at 5%, the 10-year was. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. If you're having trouble getting that must-have Apple Watch, Series 9 or Ultra 2, for that special someone in your life, blame the Constitution. That bit in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 8, which says Congress shall have the power to promote the progress of science and useful arts by securing for limited times to authors and inventors the exclusive right to their respective writings and discoveries. The discovery in question is a blood oxygen monitoring technology that a medical device company called Masimo invented and that the International Trade Commission says Apple illegally copied and used in the above-mentioned watches. The White House has until Christmas Day to overturn the ruling, but the fact is, patent wars in this economy, they go back hundreds of years, as Marketplace's Sabri Benishore tells us.
America had a patent law before it had a Bill of Rights.
Even while the Constitution was being drafted, there were rival steamboat inventors lobbying the members of the Constitutional Convention for patents.
Christopher Beecham is professor of law at Brooklyn Law School. The biggest patent wars in U.S. history actually happened 150 years ago.
The patent then was that people got fundamental patents that controlled a particular technology and then sued very large numbers of defendants.
Alexander Graham Bell sued every company who used a telephone without his permission. This happened with water wheels, sewing machines, barbed wire.
The inventor of the rubber dentures sued every dentist in the country and made basically thousands of people pay to use rubber dentures or face lawsuits.
The head of that company was later murdered by a vengeful dentist. In the 20th century, as innovation was controlled by fewer and bigger companies, patent wars became fewer too, Beecham says. But recently, they've expanded again.
Technology itself has become more complex.
Rob Merges is author of American Patent Law and professor of law at UC Berkeley.
There's more components in a lot of our products.
One smartphone can involve 250,000 patents. See the Apple Watch with the oxygen blood meter. Stephen Pepe is with law firm Ropes & Gray.
You see patent wars that are being fought not just in the U.S., but over in Europe, in China, in India, in South America.
And more recently has been the rise of what are pejoratively called patent trolls.
entities that are asserting the patents as part of an investment vehicle to make money as opposed to protect a competitive position.
Rich Miller is with law firm Ballard Spahr. Meanwhile, patent law continues to adapt. A court in the UK recently decided that AI models could not be patent owners. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Politics has been sucking up all the air in the news cycle today as we wait for the Supreme Court to decide what it's going to do about the decision out of Colorado last night, ruling Donald Trump cannot be on the presidential primary ballot there. Stayed, pending appeal, of course. Not waiting, though, is the machinery of politics, the campaigning, the strategizing, and the advertising. Unless you're in one of the early primary states, you probably haven't seen too many political ads yet. But this election is going to be the most expensive ever, and campaigns are going to be as desperate as ever to get their message in front of voters early and often, which means there are going to be more ads than ever in more places and on more platforms, and they are probably going to be a little more bespoke, too, as Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports.
For decades, the name of the game in political advertising was broadcasting, in the technical sense of the word. Wide-scale rollouts of ads designed to appeal to as many people as possible.
It's morning again in America.
But more recently, campaigns have been using increasingly detailed data to narrowcast more targeted messages to more targeted groups of potential voters. Some of this data has been around and available to campaigns for decades, says Samuel Woolley, who runs the Propaganda Research Lab at the Center for Media Engagement at UT Austin. For example, state voter files revealing your party affiliation, how often you vote, when you last voted.
And then credit reporting agencies, other financially focused firms also collect and sell information on our spending habits and a range of other commercial behaviors.
Do you own a car or a house? How likely are you to buy one? But now there are all kinds of new ways to reach voters, and all of them can tell campaigns all about us. Jesse Contario oversees the political practice at MIQ, which helps brands and campaigns target ads on digital platforms. He says there has been exponential growth in how much of this data is available to those running for office.
TV viewership data might only be available 6 years ago on 10 million households throughout the country. Now you can cobble together TV viewership data on 60 plus million households.
Add to that data the constant stream leaking from apps on our phones about where we go and who we hang out with. And then, of course, there are our internet browsing habits. Campaigns can purchase aggregated data about the videos you watch.
Hold on, you've been scrolling for way too long now.
Which sports and teams you follow.
He scores! Saw it, a power play goal! And the Blues cut the lead to 2-1.
As you're reading articles about politics, as you're reading articles about holiday recipes, all of that data is often also associated with voters so that we can do what's called contextual targeting.
So, for example, if campaigns want to show ads to people interested in education policy, they can target people looking at education-related content. All of those different streams of data can be coalesced into massive data sets that campaigns, just like traditional advertisers, buy.
These dossiers can include hundreds or even thousands of data points about us, including our religious beliefs.
Katrina Fitzgerald is deputy director at EPIC, the Electronic Privacy Information Center.
You know, how often we're going to places of worship, or even inferences about us based on what our friends are reading or where they're going.
And those dossiers help campaigns know who to target with ads and where to place those ads.
They can identify individual voters and say, you know, close to election day, make sure that that voter gets targeted with an ad to go vote or an ad, you know, slamming their opponent.
And that means that a lot of the advertising you're going to see in this next election cycle is going to be targeted towards the groups that you belong to, the place that you live, and potentially even you yourself as an individual.
UT Austin's Samuel Woolley says, especially when you add new AI tools to the mix, this cycle, campaigns will be able to parse all that data faster and quickly generate ads uniquely tailored to an individual voter.
Is micro-targeted. It's no longer the case that it's just like every voter in Missouri is seeing the same ad.
Epic's Katrina Fitzgerald.
You are being chosen for that ad based on all this data about you. And your friends aren't seeing the same information. So any conversations you're having about politics, you're not always getting the same information.
Which, in an already polarized society, might make it even harder to find common ground. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, which I will preface by noting that crude oil on this Wednesday, the international benchmark Brent North Sea, held steady at $79 a barrel. That is despite all the geopolitical agita, specifically the live fire exercises happening in the Red Sea. Why, you ask? Because the United States is producing more oil than any other country on the planet. The Energy Information Administration released the data today, 13.3 million barrels a day coming out of U.S. wells just this past week. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Jake Cherry, Justin Dueler, Drew Jostad, Gary O'Keefe, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Torrado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.